thank you to the Gomez's. The Gomez's are the sponsors for tonight's Beit Midrash programming. All four classes. It's a 4-for-1 deal. If you want to choose something to sponsor, Beit Midrash night is the one. They sponsored for Henry Clyde's 70th birthday, for those of you who were in that parade yesterday. I never realized how much people love to honk their horn until it came to a birthday celebration during COVID-19. It was pretty loud. It was pretty loud. You could not miss it. Sirens and horns. It was fun. Anyways,
if by on Shabbos, he was doing bourbon.
Oh yeah, he told me about that.
It's
he
much
told me
better. About.
I don't know. It depends who you ask, I guess. Either way, happy birthday to Henry Clyde. Thank you to the Gomez's for sponsoring on in his honor. And anyone who hasn't, you should send a happy birthday message to Henry. Or like Michael did, you go over to the house, and I'm sure he'll have some extra schnapps to give out. But I would not recommend that right now. Either way, we are up to the end of Perek Zayin in Mishlei, finishing the seventh Perek. It's been, what, 9 months of Mishlei, and we're already finishing the seventh Perek, so a pretty good pace here. Got a ways to go, obviously, but we'll see what happens. And we've only got 4 psukim left in the Perek, so we're really going to squeeze out of this what we can, because I don't want to start a new Perek and a new topic when we want to sort of stay focused on the end here. So the first pasuk here, if you remember, two weeks ago was the last time we had this class, and 2 weeks ago we spoke about the mashal of the seducing woman, right? The I don't know if it's necessarily a prostitute, but the woman who's trying to seduce I think it was a young man, according to Shlomo Melech's words. And this young man was ensnared, and all these different arguments that the woman was making to try to get him to her house. Some of it being, you can do mitzvahs, it's a good thing to come inside. We talked about them all line by line. But now Shlomo Melech switches gears, still in reference to this episode, but more in terms of his personal, you know, his personal send-away message to this man. Whoever it is. So the truth is that usually, as we've seen many, many times already, Shlomo HaMelech in Mishlei usually refers to his listener, whoever it is, as Bini. Bini meaning my son. But here he says...
He's talking to himself, isn't he?
One could make that claim. But here, let's assume he's not, because we haven't assumed that thus far. Especially now, it wouldn't be able to be understood that way, because he says the words "Viata banim." What is banim? Banim is no longer my son, but sons. Right? Sons would imply that it's not just himself, and it's not just his own son, but there are many sons. Right? If he was referring to even his personal multiple sons, it would be banai. Right, so it's not only just not Bini, it's also not Banai, it's Banim. So if you look at the Ibn Ezra points out, Ve'ata Banim ki Ha'am kibanim. What does it mean, Ha'am kibanim? You could probably understand this in a couple ways, but on its simplest level, what it means is that Shlomo Melech is talking to all Klal Yisrael. Ki Ha'am kibanim, his people, the nation of Israel, him being the son. Him being the son, him being the king, them being the people of Israel, so they're all like his sons. And that's what the Ibn Ezra is saying. Now, what I'm about to say is not the literal understanding of it, but I think there's a very interesting, you know, a very interesting lesson to be learned from here. Until now, we could have understood his use of the word son, as or my son, as a message to his own children. To his own disciplinary action, to the way that you should raise your children. Now, he had all his children too, but now it's different. Now he's not talking necessarily to his own personal children as much as he's talking to all of Klal Yisrael. And yet he nonetheless calls them Banim. Where else in the Torah where else in Tanakh do we find them, that the Jewish people are called Banim? Right? So Hashem calls us Banim. Banim atem la Hashem elokecha. I guess Moshe you know, talks through Hashem, or Hashem talks through Moshe, calls us banim, right? That we are children of Hashem. And here Shlomo Melech is reiterating that point, that they are children. It's interesting because Shlomo Melech is the one talking here. This is not necessarily from Hashem per se. Obviously, he's giving over morality and the values of Hashem, but he's talking to them as his children. So what's the purpose of the use of the of this analogy, of this phrasing, to call the Jewish people his children? And I read an interesting book recently. Which book was that? I think it's this one. I'm on a Malcolm Gladwell kick. I think I probably have told you this before, but this probably his real starter book, the one that really got him on the map, called The Tipping Point. And in The Tipping Point, he talks about a very interesting concept of the maximum size of a disciplined community. And he talks there about how to keep communities together, you have to somehow create a certain cohesion through relationships. And once the community gets too large, gets too big, so you can't create those relationships, and therefore you can't maintain the discipline. If you look at the Malbim here, so it says, "V'ata banim shimuli." The Malbim says, "My children, listen to me. Techila shimu, first listen. V'avinu hatam shedivarai tzodkim, and listen, or divarai tzodkim, listen to my words. My words are wise. My words are right. They're correct." Meaning, even with the reasonings of them, they're correct. V'achar kach hakshivu, and then pay close attention. Takshiv means to listen, not just to hear the sound waves, but takshiv, right? Lahakshiv means to really listen. My father used to say, my father is a basketball coach, he used to always start off his clinics. Whenever he would give a basketball clinic, he says, "I have two rules, listen and pay attention." Right? Those are the two rules. You can't just hear the sound waves, you also have to comprehend what's going on. So this is what the Malbim is saying. Shim'uli, listen to me. And then hakshivu means to really pay attention, right? To really, to obey, the way the Malbim is saying it. Obey, af l'imrei fi, even to the words of my mouth. Meaning it's not necessarily a very deep understanding, but imrei fi, just sort of whatever's on the surface. Just the words that are coming out of my mouth, you have to listen to, you have to pay attention to, and you have to obey. V'lo tidrusu tam klal. You don't even have the opportunity, you don't even have the right to think about the reasons. Just listen to what I'm saying, and trust me. So that's what he's saying here. Also very relevant for tomorrow's daf, for those who are holding in daf yomi. And I've got a visitor here. Usher's back. So,
He likes to learn. He's saying hi.
He does like to learn. He likes to learn, and he usually makes sounds as if he's learning. Yeah, you want to learn? He's waiting for me to talk so that he can interrupt me. But either way, so the Malbim is saying that Shlomo Melech is saying, you have to listen to my words regardless of what you think the right thing is. You have to trust me that what I'm saying is the right thing. And this is what I was talking about before, that this concept of banim, of creating that relationship with the people he's talking to as children, is itself the way that he's going to make them listen. Right? The Malbim is saying these words really this explanation within the words shim'u and hakshivu, but what he really what he could also be basing it off of is the word banim. The banim is really the glue that's going to make these words stick. And in the tipping point that I just introduced, so Malcolm Gladwell says the following on page 180. He says, "Over the years, military planners have arrived at a rule of thumb which dictates that functional fighting units cannot be substantially larger than 200 men." Dunbar writes, he's quoting, I think it's Sam Dunbar, a study from the 70s. "This, I suspect, is not simply a matter of how the generals in the rear exercise control and coordination, because companies have remained obdurately stuck at this size despite all the advances in communications technology since the First World War." I mean, it's not about ease of communication, right? Because there are many ways nowadays that we can have that communication. Rather, what does it mean? Rather, it is as thought the planners have discovered by trial and error over the centuries. that it is hard to get more than this number of men sufficiently familiar with each other so that they can work together as a functional unit. It is still possible, of course, to run an army with larger groups, but at a bigger size, you have to impose complicated hierarchies and rules and regulations and formal measures to try to command loyalty and cohesion. Those two things go together. The cohesion is what creates the loyalty. But below 150, Dunbar argues, it is possible to achieve these same goals informally. At this size, orders can be implemented and unruly behavior controlled on the basis of personal loyalties and direct man-to-man contacts. With larger groups, this becomes impossible. And then later on he says, that's what Bill Gross was saying about the Hutterite. He's talking about a community of a religious sect. That in this Hutterite community, they would grow and grow and grow until the number 150, and then they would split up. Because they realized naturally that once you get past 150, it's hard to keep that social cohesion. The fissures they see in Hutterite colonies that grow too big are the fissures that result when the bonds among some commune members begin to weaken. Meaning, the second you get too big, you no longer have that social cohesion that maintains that discipline and the loyalty to the rules or to the instructions. And while it's not exactly the same point, I thought it was very interesting that when you deal with many people, when you deal with a large group, you have to somehow create a cohesion, a social loyalty, which is bred through a kind of intimacy. And I thought maybe that's what Shlomo Malach was doing here, that the way that you make somebody, you know, listen, the way that you make somebody, a supporter or an obedient partner of some kind, is that you have to create some kind of intimacy with them. And that's presumably what Shlomo Malach is saying. Obviously, Shlomo Malach talked to a huge group of Klal Yisrael, but I think that's what he's doing in some ways, is trying to create that emotional connection with people so that they feel that this is something that they should listen to. V'ata banim shimuli, specifically my children, or children in general. Your children, meaning I am your father, and that relationship should dictate that you stay loyal to whatever I'm saying. So just a quick idea, you know, I've been reading a lot of books now, I'm quarantined, so a lot of things are sort of popping into my head. So that's just in terms of that first pasuk, that banim shimuli, specifically banim, you should listen as my children, or as children, you should know that we have a relationship. Okay, moving on. So what is he talking about? He's specifically talking about, as we spoke about in regards to last week's, 2 weeks ago, al yest el derachecha libeha, do not swerve or go into the, what does it say here? Do not wander out to her ways, your heart. Here it says, let your mind not wander down her ways. Interesting use of the word mind there. Libecha, as we know, as we've seen before, lev could oftentimes mean one's heart, your desires, but it also means one's mind, how you're thinking about doing things. Al teisa ben sivosah. And similarly, do not stray onto her paths. We haven't seen this duality from Shlomo Malach in a few prakim. At least we haven't focused on it too much, but there is a recurring contrast that Shlomo Malach oftentimes brings up, and they're related. Not such a contrast, I guess, but just a difference of modalities or physical barriers. So here the pasuk says, "Al yest el derachecha," do not wander. Onto her path, onto her ways. Derech is a way. And then the end of the pasuk says, Al tesa bin sivosa, and do not stray onto her paths. So what's the difference between derech and nesiv? We've talked about this in a few different times in a few different ways. But a derech is very general, right? Think of derech as like a way, a direction, maybe a highway. She lives this way. Right? Just that general direction. And a nesiv is much smaller. It's much more narrow. It's much more specific and unique. So when it says here, al yest el derachecha libecha, what it's saying basically is, do not follow the general path, the general you know, life perspective or lifestyle, the general direction that she's going to, or in her direction. And then furthermore, al tesa ben sivoseha, don't go specifically on her paths. So it's kind of interesting that one would think that if Shlomo Melech is trying to say that that don't do X and then don't do Y, presumably Y is not included in X. If Derachaha means the larger paths, presumably that would include the smaller paths. So now we have to figure out how do we understand this a little bit better. So the Malbim says the following. Al yest el Derachaha libecha. Haderech hu derech harabim. Right, that's what we just said. That the way is the way of the many. Many people. V'hanesiv hu nesiv hayachid. And the nesiv, the path, is a very specific path. It's very small. It's narrow. Shelo levad. It's not just. Shelo yest libecha al derecha. Dehainu liznos ima. It doesn't just mean to go in her ways. Meaning, he says, ways is here her, I don't know, profession or vocation of some kind to actually have relations with her. Ki gam al tesa bin tzivoseha. Even on the paths, her specific paths, you shouldn't go. So what does that mean? Shelo tit'e laleches bin sivos haktanos shela. Don't even go on the small paths. So it's not necessarily saying the narrow paths that literally lead to her doorstep, but it's saying the small little things that she would do. So derachaha are the big things, right? The big issues. Don't have relations with this woman. And then even furthermore, and this is why it makes sense within in the progression of the pasuk, not only should you not have the big issue, you know, with her, the big relations with her, but rather even the smaller things that you think might be more innocent, kimo ledaber ima, to speak with her, lihistakelba, to gaze at her, sheyuchal lios sheyomar belibo, because one could say in their heart, shemuvtach shlo yechtevi kabel sachar. Maybe he's sure he's not going to sin, and he's going to get rewarded for such a thing. And it quotes a similar idea here in Aramaic, which I assume is from a Gemara somewhere or a Chazal somewhere. But basically, Shlomo Melech, according to the Malbim, is saying the big things obviously don't do, but even the little things don't do, because the little things very easily turn into big things. And there's no greater example, at least for us today, of little things turning into big things than what we're all dealing with now. And obviously, it's a continual process of trying to figure out how little is little and how big is big and how much is how where's the threshold where little is going to lead into big. I don't know if anyone saw what was going on in Israel, but they've opened up their schools in one way or another over the last 3-4 weeks. I don't know when they completely opened their schools. I don't know if they have completely opened their schools. But here's just a snippet of what's going on in Israel. It's an article on, the Jerusalem Post from Mayan Jaffe, who actually I used to know. I know her husband. We're somewhere friendly. But so she wrote the following. Any school that is found, this is quoting Israeli policy now. Any school that is found to have an active case, just one active case of coronavirus, will be closed immediately to stop its spread among education institutions. Education Minister Yoav Gallant said on Monday. So this actually is not, this is a brand new policy. Before they were willing to have a case or a few cases and then shut down the whole school by quarantine and then quarantining the people that person is associated with. Now if they have one case, they're shutting down the whole school because they've seen an uptick in cases. And the numbers, because of these schools and because of other things, have started to rise again in Israel. And they're very concerned. And there are some criticisms about, you know, how they went about having the classrooms without masks or with too many kids in the room, etc. But either way, in recent days, there has been a surge in coronavirus infection throughout the country, especially in schools. A report disseminated Monday afternoon by the Education Ministry showed that there were 13 new students and teachers diagnosed with coronavirus in the last day, and that the number in isolation tripled. Now, this is a difficult, you know, for us in America, we look at the number 13, we're like, 13? That's nothing. But in Israel, You know, a place that was able to keep the amount of deaths through the entire situation to under 300, which obviously is terrible, but relative to everywhere else in the world is unbelievable how they were able to sort of stay ahead of it. The fact that there were 13 new infections after they've already been cleared to reopen society in one day is a big deal. And this is basically, you know, basically the fear that many have, which is we have to be very careful about how we reopen. And the more difficult part is that you don't really know how much has happened for another, for 10 to 20 days until after it's happened, because it doesn't, you don't really show signs. So that's the real difficulty. But I was reminded of it from this Malbim, who basically says you have to worry that even though you might think, Nasivo Seha, just the small little things, you'll go down the path without a mask one day. You'll get, you'll be wearing a mask, but, you can talk to somebody from 3 feet away. You never know what Nasiv, what path, what small thing is going to turn into a big thing. And I'm reading, the tipping point, getting more to the crux of the book, besides what we were talking about before, the crux of the book is really called the tipping point because it's talking about what he calls, and probably not the best word to use in today's sensitive society, but what he calls epidemics. And he calls even positive things epidemics, because what he talks about is basically how small things can turn into big things when it comes to fashion, when it comes to actual illness, but also when it comes to messaging and concepts and ideas. And it's an interesting read in terms of how little, it says here, how little things can make a big difference. That's the point of the book. And it's very interesting. And he talks, if people are familiar on the positive side, he talks about broken windows theory. I know people are familiar with broken windows theory. I think we probably have talked about it before. Okay, Asher, all done, okay? We've talked about, I think, about it in other contexts. But the broken windows theory was something I believe that happened in New York in, the 70s or the 80s, in the 90s? Was it already in the 90s? Steve is saying it was under Giuliani, which is definitely true that Giuliani is credited with some of the success of lowering crime rates. But and there are a whole different reasons that people suggest, etc. But one of the possibilities is the broken windows theory. And part of the broken windows theory is that if you change small things about the context of where a person lives, so that can actually change the attitude and change the lifestyle of that person. So as opposed to a person walking through streets with broken windows and with broken down homes and things like that, you walk in a place that's upkept and it's organized and it's clean. You yourself want to maintain that certain cleanliness, either because of pride or because through osmosis, it supports a kind of well-being that goes into your behavior as well. And those small things can make a big difference. So here too, the Malbim is explaining, Shlomo Melech is saying basically to the Banim, to his children, that not only should you not go do the deed, Al yeste el derecheha libecha, do not go over to her big paths, the big issues, but even the sivoseh, even the smaller things, can obviously bring you to greater issues later on in the relationship. So that's sort of step number one. Don't go on the path. Don't go on the ways, and also don't go on the paths. Why shouldn't you do that? So now he says Shlomo Melech in Pasuk Chavav, Ki rabim chalalim hipila. It's an interesting word. That for many are those she has struck dead. Chalalim. Chalalim is sort of like emptied or defiled. Different ways of translating it. Like Chilul Shabbos. Right? So Ki rabim chalalim hipila. She has struck down many empty ones. Va'atsumim kol harugeha. And numerous are her victims. Atsumim is interesting. It's atsumim, which here it's translating as numerous, is really just trying to... you're saying hi or bye? You're saying bye? Okay, bye. Okay, so you're saying hi? Okay, you're saying hi. Atsumim here, they're translating it as numerous because it is in parallel in the pasuk to the word rabim. Okay, go upstairs, okay? Rabim and atsumim are here are parallel, and therefore they translate it here as numerous. But atsum doesn't really mean numerous. It means great or powerful, right? So like Otsem Yadi, right? The strength of my hand, Otsem Yadi Asali Asachayel Azeh. That is my strength. So what does it mean, the strength? So if you look here at the Rav Paninim, which is the Rav Moshe Alshech, he says the following. V'hine ad ko dibarti lefi darkecha, asher timtza lomar kilo yukshuba rabim. Maybe you would think that not many people fall into this trap. Maybe you'll think that this type of thing, as the Shlomo Melech even started off the whole story at the beginning of Perek Zayin, if you remember, not the beginning, in the middle of Perek Zayin, he says in Pasuk Vav, Ki b'chalon b'si ba'ad eshnabi nishkafti. I looked out my window, v'ayre b'psa'im avinak babanim na'ar chasar lev. I saw amongst many of the simpletons, many of the fools, I saw one person. Na'ar chasar lev. There's one person who was missing his heart. He was sort of off the beaten path. So maybe you would think, says the Al-Sheikh, maybe you would think that dictates that it's only one person out of many people that would have this struggle. Asher timsa lomar ki lo yukshu barabim. Not many people are going to struggle with this. Rak echad miklal merubim. Maybe it's one person out of many. Maybe 1% of people have these difficulties. Maybe one out of every 1,000 people have these difficulties. Al kein amarti. Therefore, says Shlomo HaMelech, according to the Al-Sheikh, he says, sheyizharu merubim. Everyone should be worried about this. Because of that one possibility. Every single person should be worried about themselves. Because everyone makes mistakes. Many people she has dethroned or brought down. Even many people are having this war, this internal struggle. Right? So it says, Lech Mubalachama, Yisa'asa du lipol chalalim. That it is going to create a future falling of these people. Chalalim, chalalim, as we say in Asher Yatzar, these empty people. In Asher Yatzar, it means like an orifice or a hole that Hashem created. Mechaye olam, ki rabim ahipila uvachata mesu. And with that sin, or with her sin, they died. And don't raise your thought to say, Ulai mishololei. Maybe they were people that were a little foolish. They didn't have a lot of wisdom. Misholal chacham, right? They didn't. They were bereft of wisdom. Therefore, she was able to win them over. Ah, however, ish navon v'chacham ani. I am a smart and intelligent person. Umi kamoni bi Yisrael. Who else is like me and all the Jewish people? Ani arbe lasuk ba. I am going to deal with her in many ways. V'lo tasor levavi. And my heart's not going to be swayed. Ki halo v'atzumim hayu. And therefore Shlomo Melech says, behold, atzumim hayu kol harugeha. The people that she has killed, that she is ensnared in this trap, were very mighty people. Berov chachma, they had a lot of wisdom. Atzumim, they were mighty, they were great, they were strong. Ki halo ein lecha mishtaakim bechachma betos, bechachmas tos. Ki im rabei hasechel, the people that are going to fall victim to this type of mistake are those who have a lot of intelligence. Hamishtokekim chadudeha ubotchim b'tzal chachmasam. They're the ones that are complacent. They're the ones that think that they're so smart. And they're going to have confidence in b'tzal chachmasam. It's a very interesting phrase. In the shadow of their wisdom. Meaning they might look at themselves and think they're very wise. They might think that they're very accomplished in their intelligence. But it's really b'tzel chachmasam. They're hiding in the shade of what they think is intelligence. Bal yimotu, that they're not going to fall off. Lachein yishamer kein tamus gam ata ke'achar mihem, because you too will die just like one of them. You can't be any smarter than them, because these are some of the smartest people. Ooh, a hamburger. Thank you. Thank you. A hot dog. Thank you. Sorry, just had to have another dinner. So this is what Shlomo Melech is saying. According to the Al-Sheikh, you might think that you have superior intelligence. And therefore, he says, Atsumim kol harugeha. The people that she ensnares are Atsumim. The way that Rav Peninim explains it is very intelligent people, very high IQ people. And this reminded me of another book that I've been reading from Malcolm Gladwell that I just read this part today. So this is hot off the rabbi's mind, called Outliers. Another one of his books called Outliers. And he talks about an interesting study that was done. Oh, thank you. There was a man by the name of, what's his name? Terman, I think. Oh man, I forgot his name. Lewis Terman. Lewis Terman, after World War II, not sure what sparked his interest in this, but he wanted to look at the success of people with very high IQs. He thought that by tracking early on the highest IQ'd children and following their paths in life, we'd be able to really understand the makings of a genius or the makings of someone very accomplished. And he was expecting that these kids would be able to go on to accomplish great things in sciences and in literature and win Nobel Prizes in general. And the truth is that these people, these kids were on average, the IQ was 151, which is apparently very high. And like about 1,000 kids or something. And they claimed 35 years later, they claimed that it was a big success and they found all these successful people. But the truth is, if you dig into the data, it's not very clear. And here's just an interesting summary I found about this on Psychology Today. The final group of termites, that's what they called them because his name was Terman. I don't know why they called him that. Even if your name has a good pun, that doesn't mean you use the word termites. But either way, averaged a whopping IQ of 151. Following up his group 35 years later, his gifted group at midlife definitely seemed to conform to his expectations. They were taller, healthier, physically better developed, and socially adept. And then he goes through a few of the stats of how much they published in journals, etc. Is this impressive? Certainly. Is there more to the story that meets the eye? Absolutely. William Shockley was among the elementary school children tested by Terman's researchers in the 20s. His IQ was not high enough to be a termite, so he was shut out of the experiment and was not deemed gifted. By the way, nowadays with all these gifted, there are a lot of gifted programs in schools. A lot of it is based on this study of of honing in on those who are gifted and making sure that they get the proper advanced education. Either way, so he says they were shut out of the experiment. William Shockley was shut out, undismayed. Shockley went on to Harvard and got a PhD. He joined Bell Telephone Laboratories and helped devise the point contact transistor in 1947 and the junction transistor in 1948. This latter accomplishment earned him the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1970. Later as a professor, as he dusted his prize in his office at Stanford University, he looked at the list of accomplishments by the termites and realized that not one of them held the trophy that was now in his possession. None of the termites, the 1,000 kids with the highest IQs in the country, none of them had a Nobel Prize. A lot of people know about Terman's study, but don't know the truth about it. It was recently estimated that while the list of accomplishments by termites was undoubtedly impressive, they did not come close in caliber to the true scientific elite of the same nation and era. So while it's true, these kids were very smart and they went on have accomplished careers in different fields, the odds of getting someone who is just as accomplished or even more accomplished could have been greater if he would have looked elsewhere at different qualities. Many also point out that he just simply took, kids in higher classed families. Middle to high class and socioeconomic status kids. And if they would have just stopped the study without the IQ, they would have gotten the same results in that whole class. You would have the same that you would have the same data to work with afterwards. So in the end of the day, what we find is that despite his understanding that the IQ is something which is dictating of great intelligence, it's true, it does dictate great intelligence, but great intelligence does not make great people necessarily, great achievers necessarily, depending where you set your bar. So here too, when Shlomo Melch is saying, Atzumim kol harugah, you might think that these people that she's ensnaring are fools, or that they don't know anything, or that they're not well educated. The truth is, Atzumim kol harugah, these people are very well educated. And don't think that just because of your education or your perceived intelligence that you're going to be any better than everyone else. Because your intelligence is not indicative, just like this termite study is not necessarily indicative of any extraordinary talent or ability that's going to help you get past any challenges other people can't get past. He goes on to talk about a person, what's his name? Langdon. I don't know if people know Langdon. Very smart guy. His IQ was like 200 or something. Who also was a brilliant guy, but really wasn't really able to climb the ladder of any, you know, anything that general society would deem successful. I talked about that in the book also. Again, to say, and there are problems with the IQ test, and what exactly the IQ test, whatever. But that's the point of the termite study, that just because someone's intelligent doesn't necessarily mean that they'll be able to withstand challenges. And that's exactly what Shlomo Melech is saying in this Atzumim Kol Harugah. She ensnares the brightest of people. And the last pasuk in this parak, in Parak Zion, Darchei Sheol Besa Yordos El Chadri Maves. Her house is a highway to Sheol, the pits, either literally or figuratively, leading down to death's inner chambers. So what are these two stages? So the mom has a very interesting take here. He says, Ki Darchei Sheol Besa HaSheol Hu Habor HaAmok. It's a very deep pit. V'yitzuyar. And you can imagine sheyipol bo kodem shiamus, a person would fall into that pit before they die. Verotzelomar, and it's therefore saying, in other words, mishta holech afilu derech besa, even if a person is going in the general direction of her house, even if you think you're not going to get there, and even if you think you're going to turn right before you get to the house, once you're already on the path, kvar holech bedarchei sheol, you've already sunk to a depth. V'yipol b'bor amok, and you're going to fall into a deep pit. V'yitzayir shebechadarim ha'amuk m'shal ha'sheol, and in the depths of those pits, you're going to fall into sheol, whatever sheol is translated as. Yoshev ha'maves, and in those pits, you're going to find death. U'mishaba b'sheol misham, yodos l'chadri maves, and when a person falls into one of the pits, you're ultimately going to die. Rotolomar yavol l'dei avera, which death here is basically just a euphemism for actually succumbing to the sin. You might think that you're going to be able to avoid it. You might think you're going to be able to outsmart it, but you have to know ki darchei sheol besa, the way of the path is just her house. Yardos al chadrei maves is ultimately the culmination of going down this path, but in the short term, just the path itself is damaging. And this is something which I think I'd probably go in a different direction as the Malbim to say that oftentimes, even when we do have structures, we do have things in place that can hold us back and that can make sure we don't go over the edge in one way or another, falling into a pit is bad too. And I think sometimes we underestimate the gravity or the significance of going to what we call a pitfall because we might feel that we're more confident in not going over the edge, and maybe we didn't go over the edge. We talked about this a few months ago, though. When you dabble in certain things, when you start to think about certain ideas and certain concepts, they do make an impression on your mind. And even if you haven't actually fallen, or you actually haven't actually failed the ultimate test, along the way you're going to be failing, and it's going to have an impression. It's going to leave an impact on your mind and on your behavior down the road that you're not going to understand necessarily, maybe subconsciously, maybe it'll come up later. We talked a little bit, if you remember, a few months ago, back when we met in person, we talked about the difficulty of, you know, the seed that you plant sometimes when you think about different things, or when you investigate different things, or you dabble in different things, that maybe right now you're very careful and it's not going to affect you, but down the road, when something terrible happens, that thought's going to be in your mind, and you're going to shift your perspective on things based on having already engaged with those risky belief systems. So either way, that's how I would have taken it a little bit more, and sort of extend the Malbim a little bit more to say that even if you're not going to get actually to her house, and you're not actually going to do the derech, as the Malbim said earlier, you're not going to do the big thing, then the sieve itself, the path itself, is not only going to ultimately lead to the big thing, but even the path itself is somewhat difficult, and it's darchei she'ol. The path itself is going to imprint on you something that you don't that you shouldn't have, something that you shouldn't get involved in, either for the present or for the future. It's not going to be helpful for you. So either way, that's the end of Perek Zayin. And if you have if you're a little bit overwhelmed or sort of already convinced of all the negatives, hopefully next week we're going to start with some of the positives. David Amel, Shlomo Amel is going to shift back into gear of saying what wonderful things you can do with Chachma and wonderful things you can do with Torah. Hopefully we'll get into some more positive psychology as opposed to negative psychology. So hopefully you join me next week, Monday night at 8 o'clock, for our next perek and our next installment of Mishle and Modern Psychology. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Have a good night. And again, as a public service announcement, apparently it's supposed to rain. So you